Hi, welcome to Motorcycle Views with me, Dave Marsden, here on Fab Radio International, brought to you by Z-Power, Kawasaki parts specialist. This show is all about news, views, information and anything else going on in the motorcycle world. We'll have guests, tips, travelling advice and reviews on anything motorcycle related. You can email us at motorcycleviews@yahoo.com. I'm joined also by my wonderful producer, Michelle. So let's get on with the show. Welcome everybody, Dave Marsden here. Who in the heck is Dave Marsden, you're thinking? Well, I'm a motorcyclist. I can't emphasise that enough. It's all I've ever known. I've been working in the motorcycle trade for over 43 years. I eat, breathe, live motorcycles. I ride them, I build them, I fix them, I even polish them. I'm mad for it. So this show is all about motorcycling, funny enough. Well, welcome to show four. On this week's show, we have our second part of our interview with engine restorer Steve Smethurst. We've got a review on the Royal Enfield 650 Interceptor. We've got some questions and answers and a chat with John Spencer from Yorkshire's leading Zero dealer. That's the electric bikes. But first, let's do the news. Well, of course, we're on lockdown here in the UK, so riding our bikes is restricted to riding to the shops for essential goods. Or maybe riding to work. That's if you actually are at work. But it is what it is. I've had to record most of this week's show from home, but with a little help from the IT guys at Fab Radio, at least we've got a show. Okay, good news to start with. The government have told us we can have a 6 month extension to our MOTs. So from the 1st of April, you don't need to MOT your bike. That's if it's run out in that month, of course. So you'll have till October before you have to MOT it again. Typical, eh? I just did mine last week. Manchester Bike Show, which should have been next weekend, that's been cancelled. There's no surprise there. No racing, of course, motorcycle racing. And nobody's sure when it's going to kick off again. But at least BT Sport and Eurosport are running repeats of past races. All worth watching again, of course. And now some bad news. TT winner, legend Tony Rutter, has died. He won the Isle of Man TT 7 times. He won the Northwest 200 9 times and the Ulster Grand Prix 5 times. I think he also won a couple of British championships as well. Sad times indeed. Right, next on the news. Not that there is much, of course. 4th of April sees the start of the annual Round Britain Rally. If you've not heard of this, then listen up. It's a rally in which you visit 80 targets all over the UK, well, Scotland, Wales and England. You get over 6 months to do it, so hopefully this will be plenty of time once this lockdown thing is over. There's different points for each target to a total of 2,000 points. Some of the easy targets are just 15 points each, but some of the harder targets, like in the Scottish Highlands, they're worth like 50 points. You don't have to do them all, of course. You just do the ones you want. I've been doing it for many, many years. It's well worth the effort. It takes you to places you'd never dream of going, and places you never even heard of, but it's really, really good. Anyway, if you fancy it, more details from their website, which is www.roundbritainrally.co.uk. Give it a go. So that's the news. Next up is our weekly road test.
Kids, be quiet. I'm trying to listen to That Dave Marsden on Fab Radio International. It's Europe's biggest and best radio station.
Dad, can I have a motorbike?
I was in Millennium Motorcycles in St Helens the other day, waiting for them to get a Suzuki Katana ready for me for a test ride. And super salesman there, Kev Parker, offered me a Royal Enfield 650 Interceptor to try out while I was waiting. Not on my agenda, but I thought, what the hell, why not? The Interceptor is a twin-cylinder bike from Royal Enfield. It's their newest offering and their first twin-cylinder for over 50 years, I think. I think they're actually dropping the 500 single, so they're pushing a lot of interest into this. I wasn't expecting much, but wow, it really surprised me. Let's do a bit of the tech stuff first. Not that there's much tech stuff to do, of course, on a Royal Enfield. But it's a pretty simple bike. It's a retro-type bike, of course, with not many frills, which I guess is what it's all about. I suppose if you're looking for a bike like that, you're not interested in electronics. Well, it's a four-stroke, single overhead camshaft, eight-valved, air-cooled parallel twin. It's got 47 brake horsepower with just over 38 foot-pounds of torque. A six-speed gearbox, fuel-injected, of course, and a good-sized oil cooler at the front, which looks like a radiator at first. I was a bit confused. Enfield claim a top speed of about 100 miles an hour. Emphasis on the about. It's got a single disc up front with a twin-piston caliper and a single at the back. ABS, of course, because they all have to have ABS. But it's got no traction control and it's got no power modes. All the better for it, really. 18-inch wheels front and rear and chain drive. The weight is claimed to be 213 kilos. Tank capacity is nearly 14 litres, which at, say, 60 miles to the gallon will give you a range of about 150 miles. More than enough on a bike like this. The suspension is pretty basic, as you imagine, but the piggyback rear shocks have three preloads and they look great. Clocks are retro-style analogue dials, but there is a little LCD panel in the speedo with a little extra information. All you need, really, on a bike like this. Seat height is 804 millimetres. So what's it like? Well, I have to say, right away, it's brilliant. No, really, it is. It's brilliant. It surprised me more than any other bike I've recently ridden. I don't know, maybe because I had no preconceptions or maybe because it was just a Royal Enfield. But yeah, wow. In any case, I was smiling inside my helmet from the minute I set off to the moment I got off it. I think I can say without a shadow of a doubt, it had the sweetest gearbox of any bike I've ever ridden. Changing gear was like, it was like an electric switch. Absolutely amazing. The motor, yeah, it's a gem. Smooth. Quite a bit of grunt considering it's only got 39 foot-pound of torque. And the fueling is great. I mean, injection just felt just right. It's got a really good power delivery. Well, I'm using the term power loosely. But yeah, it's good. The exhaust sound was good, although I guess many owners will be looking at those aftermarket noise unit items that they do. I think they're made by S&S in America. The clutch is it's light, progressive. Feels just right, feels good. All right, it's no racer, but for what it is, it's perfect. I can't believe I'm saying this about a Royal Enfield, but yeah, it's really, really good. Acceleration. Acceleration is good enough for any situation, I would think, but if you need a quick overtake, you'll need to change down a few gears. But with that gearbox, you don't really mind. It was a pleasure. The brakes are just about adequate, but they do need a really good squeeze, especially the front one. If the bike was any faster, then another disc up front would you definitely need. But as it is, yeah, good. At an indicated 70 miles an hour, our speed limit, of course, the engine was running at 4,000 revs per minute, which was perfect. It was good, just in the engine's sweet spot. The riding position was really good, even for me at 6'3". The bar to seat to footrest spacing, which is sometimes a problem, that was just right. Being a naked bike, though, there was a bit of wind buffeting at motorway speeds. There's nothing to stop it. Handling was excellent. It was light, of course, you'd expect from a 650 middleweight. But the front end felt superb. It's got that confidence-inspiring feel to it. The turning circle was really good, and feet-up U-turns were a doddle. It's fitted with Pirelli Phantom tyres, and they give good grip. And it give you a good overall feel. It just felt right. I didn't expect quality tyres at this price level, another surprising bonus. OK, it got a little choppy over 70 miles an hour. I know I shouldn't have been doing that, but I don't know what the rear shocks were set up for. I didn't touch them. It's even got a front fender extender as standard, one of the first things I ever fit on a new bike. And it's got a centre stand. Absolutely brilliant. It was a joy to ride. Reminded me of my old 2001 Kawasaki W650, which I guess is what it's up against. Well, it's the W800 now, of course. The Triumph Street Twin is another option, of course. The Triumph produces nearly 20 brake horsepower more,
but both these alternatives are nearly £2,500 more, which makes the Enfield seem such a bargain. Having said that, if you compare the three together, you can see where the extra money's gone. What about reliability? I know the old 500 Enfields were a bit, well, let's say temperamental, but Enfield have set up a two-stage quality control check on this model, and from what I can see, it's screwed together as good as anything else I've tested. The paint looks good, the chrome looks good, looks really deep in places. Although, I must admit, at times when you're looking down at it, it does look like a bit of a parts bin special. But you've got to remember, it's built to a price, and Enfield have done a really good job of it. It's no coincidence that a British frame builder's Harris Performance got involved. And now that MotoGP are in charge of the distribution, then it makes a lot more sense to own one. At just under £5,700 here in the UK on the road, this has got to be on your shopping list if you're looking for a modern retro bike. The bad bits? See, I've got to think about this. Bad bits. The mirrors are rubbish. You need to change them. The crossbar on the handlebars looks a little naff, but they sell a like a little pad to go on it, so that's there for a reason. The seat cover pattern leaves a little to be desired. Looks like a quilt. And the seat itself seems a little under-padded. But, you know, it felt okay on my short test ride. I don't know how it would work out on a longer one. The side stand did seem a little too short for my liking. Makes me panic when they're like that. Yes, it's not very powerful, but if you need more power, then you're looking at the wrong type of bike. Other than that, it was superb. Enfield are offering a large range of extras and accessories, as they all do these days, at very reasonable prices, which would have to be with the price of the bike being so cheap. They do a touring screen at £110, engine bars at £120, those noisy performance exhausts, they're £549. A touring seat at £140. Don't know if that's taller or shorter, I'm not sure. They do some soft luggage and loads more like branded options. They even do like a clothing range. Who would have thought it of Enfield, eh? The colour options for the bike are really attractive, with a cream colour, a red, a black and a silver, and a really retro chrome finish tank. And they do a bright orange. The two-tone options are a few hundred quid more, and that chrome tank thing is, I think it's nearly 500 quid extra, which sounds stupid, doesn't it, when the bike's only 5,500. Steady on Enfield, you're turning into BMW, charging for colour options. What's the world coming to? Anyway, Enfield give a 3-year warranty with roadside assistance included. Makes me smile to see manufacturers no longer refer to it as breakdown cover. There's some great finance deals on them as well, on the entire range. You can be riding an Interceptor for less than 90 quid a month on a 4-year PCP deal. Last year, the Interceptor was constantly in the top 3 selling motorcycles above 125cc, which speaks for itself. If you want a classic-looking bike without all the classic bike problems, then this is perfect. You really need to ride one to believe it. Thanks to Kevin at Millennium Motorcycles, one of the Northwest premier motorcycle dealers.
This is Fat Radio International. Embrace the alternative.
This week we've got part two of our interview with Steve Smethurst. Steve is a restorer of motorcycle parts. Okay, I've got some more questions for you. Last time we spoke about the restoration of bikes and how you sort of went from restoring them to cleaning them, which I guess is still restoring them, but you'd gone to a more down to your roots, cleaning engines for other people rather than restoring your bikes yourself. Now, you don't just clean engines, Steve. You're a pretty good engineer yourself and you're a pretty good engine builder. In fact, you're a wizard engine builder. What do you prefer, though? Would you prefer working on engines or do you prefer cleaning them?
Well, thanks for that compliment. You're the first person to say that, incidentally.
No, well, it's true.
Well, the fact of the matter is that I restored lots of motorcycles as a younger person, and inevitably the engines would have been in a poor condition. And bearing in mind that one sells these motorcycles with some kind of warranty, I had to pay a lot of attention to detail on all the moving parts that perform a certain function. So I had to buy precise measuring equipment, for example, distortion gauges, milling machines and so on. Some of these engines had to be repaired because, for example, you could not buy a cylinder head economically. So I invested in tools and took advice from numerous people. And as the years and years and years went by, you become infinitely more proficient than what you were at the age of 16, for example.
Yeah.
Some repairs, like slipper blade wear and so on, requires milling machines and serious measurement to rectify. And repairs like that are time-consuming,
yeah.
And I really did make the effort. Now, lots of engines come with skimmed cylinder heads. Now, how many times have you heard this expression? It's only a few thou off it, it won't make any difference.
Yeah, yeah.
You've heard that one,
yeah,
haven't
prevalent
you?
In the car trade, I think, where it doesn't really matter, but on a motorcycle engine, it can make a bit of a difference, can it?
It does, because most motorcycle engines have camshafts which have the moment of highest lift at around 110 degrees. The trouble is, when folks skim the head, the skim amount is doubled because the cam chains run up and down engine. So it doubles the play in the rear side of the cam chain. Now, when that happens, you'll have noticed it yourself. When you install the camshafts, you notice that they're not quite in the position that you remember them being as a youth. So working that out, making adjustments to the position of the camshaft and so on, makes you a bit of an expert, if that's what you mean by expert.
Yeah,
right. But at least I was able to ensure that the engines that I rebuilt were functioning exactly as the manufacturers intended them to. I don't want to take credit for doing things like rebores. I don't do that. I subcontract.
Yeah.
But the attention to detail, such as camshafts, crankshafts, and so on, is something I've had to pay a lot of attention to. And if you think that's what makes me good, then good.
Yeah, the problem there, Steve, is that obviously that's time-consuming and you're going to be charging the money for it. I would imagine, I've been in the trade a long time, people can be a bit reluctant to spend money on things that they can't see.
You're right.
So in fact, it's okay, you're telling them what you've done and all the rest of it, but then I'm thinking, did it really need that? Is he just telling me that?
Well, my attitude to that problem was to disassemble the engine and show the customer all the worn parts and what was wrong with it. In fact, I became so experienced at it that I could even tell the customer how thick a standard cylinder head should be and what theirs was in reality and what was likely to be ahead of them in terms of cost. As you say, they're astounded at the cost.
Yeah.
I would say these days, some four-cylinder engines that are in poor condition, £5,000 to put right. If you're very lucky, you might get one done for £3,000, but that would be luck.
Yeah, I know. I get to people asking me all the time, you know, they expect me to tell them over the phone exactly what's wrong with their bike, and they'll explain, well, it knocks at this revs, and then at this revs it goes away. Fortunately, or sadly, depending on how you look at it, because I've been doing it for so long, I normally know exactly what's up with it.
Yes.
But then when you tell them what parts they need, they're horrified.
Yes.
They think they can just spend £20 on it and it'll be fixed.
Yes, exactly right. So I would rebuild these engines and buy the parts. And as I said before, they would be staggered by the cost, but they would understand it usually. But another aspect of this engine building is liability.
Exactly.
I would be dealing with 40-year-old components, some of which would have hairline fractures in them, not visible to eye. And after a rebuild, if a fault like that occurs, customers expect me to put it right. So you could end up doing the job twice. That's completely unsatisfactory because, like most small businesses, yours included, you have rents, rates, gas, water, electric to pay, and in that period of liability, you can't cover cost.
No.
So I'm not too keen on taking on work which has an unpredictable nature. But I prefer the casting cleaning because that is predictable.
I understand what you're saying.
But I'm very happy to build them because they're interesting.
Yeah.
Carburettors in particular, we could talk all day about those, but again, it's a depressing subject.
Yeah. And a dying subject, carburation, like everything's fuel injected these days. In 20 years' time, we'll be storing things with fuel injection. It'll be a doddle. Or then again, it might not be with all those electrics.
Believe me, it won't be.
No.
I had to do a Ducati recently, which had all the electronic gizmos that you're referring to.
Yeah.
And to be perfectly honest, I struggled with it. Fortunately, I understand microvoltage and I was able to do some tests, but I still wasn't satisfied. So I took it to a friend who had one of those computers that one plugs into machine hardware. And he discovered I had 35 faults on it, which amazed me. But he cured them in about 10 seconds by pressing a button.
Oh, right.
So that it must be the way
forward. So just unplugging it and plugging it back in again, basically.
Yes, I think you register a fault if you take a spark plug suppressor crap off these days.
Yeah, that's often the case, especially on modern.
Yeah, but there's life in restoration of old carburettors because they all have problems. They're all oxidised. They're all fused together. And somebody like me who enjoys that work.
Steve, they were no good 45 years ago. They're not going to get any better.
Well, they're not going to get
cleaner.
Better.
They might get cleaner.
They'll get cleaner. I can get them back to how they should be.
Exactly,
I think.
Which were no good, yeah. We just, in those days, we didn't know any better. We didn't realise on the correct fueling that the electronics give, the carburetors always give a flat spot.
I must admit, when I ride modern motorcycles, I can't help but be impressed.
Yeah, yeah.
They're fantastic.
I know.
I'd recommend it to anybody. And anything that they want restoring, bear in mind, you're going to be riding it once or twice a year in reality.
Yeah. Well, some of us ride it a bit more, but yeah, you're right. Yeah. And going back to the £5,000 for an engine rebuild, I remember you probably 15 years ago saying to me, Dave, do you think if I built an engine and cleaned it and put all new parts, we'd be able to sell them for £2,000? And I remember saying to you, nah, that's much too expensive. And now £2,000?
Yes, I know. Yes.
I mean, it's still a lot of money, don't get me wrong, but I mean, compared to what people are paying these days.
Yes.
I mean, I get it all the time, people saying, oh, yeah, I've got a mechanic building, and this is like a friend mechanic, mates rate, and he's only charging me £4,000. I think, oh, my God, £4,000. Of course, because I do it myself, I never think about these things, because my labour's free, of course, to myself.
I'll give you an example of how I had a similar idea to yourself there about costs and so on. I decided that people might like an exchange service with carburettors, for example.
Yeah, that'd work.
Yeah, would it?
I think
I had a go.
Oh.
Right, and I restored four sets of them. And because I did everything, new parts, which I got from some of which came from you, zinc plating, cleaning, pressure setting of slide heights, pressure setting of mixture screws and so on. They were absolutely perfect and looked the part as well. The trouble is they cost about £850.
Yeah, which is
so
a lot more.
Exchange.
Yeah.
And I placed an advertisement on eBay thinking I would be inundated with people buying these carbs. Not one response.
No, later
not
50.
One response.
I think the problem there is like, what do you charge for cleaning a complete four-cylinder engine? About £500?
No, nowhere near.
Isn't that cheaper?
£325.
Well, yeah, so if you look at a big engine at £325, then you see this little set of carburettors, and oh, there's thousands of moving parts.
Well, it's not just cleaning, Dave, it's
setting them up. Yeah.
Setting them up.
In fact, I think you were the first person to offer a setting up service when the carburettors weren't even on the bike. You spent a lot of time in...
Oh, yes, I have pressure measurement and vacuum measurement tools, so I can set slide heights and mixture screws to standard tolerances before it's married up to the engine. But that does not mean that that it dispenses with the need for vacuum gauges. But I do know that they're about right and as good as it's going to get.
No, I can vouch for the fact I've put your carburettors on and they start up with hardly any choke, which is always a good sign, and they run and they tick over. And even though I pay you that money and I think, oh, God, it really hurts me to pay that money, and then
I start the bike up and I think, oh, yeah, it was.
And you can afford it, Dave. Some of your customers must bark.
Yes, well, they do. When I tell them, people say, can I get my car Brett's restored? And I say, oh, yeah, Steve Smethurst, he's your guy. How much will it be? Oh, about £800.
Exactly, exactly. It's, and yet, if they were to sit down and work out how much they cost,
yeah,
put a value against their labour, they would soon realise that that price is very reasonable.
Well, that's right, because if they buy the parts off Z-Power, it's about £300 to get all the bits and pieces.
Yes.
So, and then they've got to get the zinc plating done, and they've got to get the cleaning done.
Exactly.
And then they've got the know-how of how to put them together, which a lot of people do put them together wrong, of course.
Yes, and I've had numerous jobs in the past where people have attempted to rebuild their carburettors, and I literally take one look at them and I can tell virtually straight away what's wrong.
Yeah, I've
seen it's a nice source of income, actually.
Yeah. Even the simple things like putting the choke levers on the wrong side upside down, and
there's lots of little things to look
on
at.
All the time.
Lots of little things to check.
Talking of that, you must have seen some bodges in your time. What's the worst ones? I mean, because you don't just do Japanese engines, you've got British engines, Italian engines.
The worst one in the past was a two-stroke Yamaha, which had a holed piston, and that had been repaired with a roofing bolt, and surprisingly, it worked.
Yeah, well, it would. Roofing bolts.
Roofing bolt repair of a holed piston, that was one. I found $300 and some drugs in a tailpiece of a bike I imported.
Have you still got the drugs?
No, I used those many years ago.
Right.
And the most surprising one recently has been a very expensive restoration. If you think Zeds are dear, you ought to try renovating something like an Aerial Square
4. Oh, I've seen that in your workshop. Yeah, is it not finished yet?
4 years later, I can say I'm on the home run.
4 years.
It's been time-consuming, Dave. One ends up having to get tappet covers cast at foundries because the original components are so life-expired. But there was a bodge in that, which I didn't spot, and somebody had put in a tube to stop oil coming out of the breather. Trouble was, it also stopped air getting out of the engine.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the problem of hydraulic lock occurred. Yeah. Sounds easy now that I'm talking about it in front of you. It took me 3 days to realise that this tube, which looked like a manufactured part, shouldn't have been there. But, in fact, if we can just slip off the chosen path a minute, one of the big problems these days with British motorcycle restoration is that people with substantial product knowledge of the bikes and what's available for them and how things work are dying off. There aren't so many of them around. Now, in the Japanese world, people like you have got all the old Super Session part list numbers, know everything about frame changes to design and so on.
Yep.
So if I had any difficulty, I could always ring you and ask what happened with this part number, and you could give me chapter and verse.
Yeah.
Try that with 6-volt direct current charging systems.
Mm.
The number of people with knowledge is diminishing, and it's diminishing rapidly.
Yeah.
So one takes jobs on like that. It's from first principles. Just as an example, I once spoke to you quite recently about a bike I had in the workshop, and I was prepared to tell the customer that the frame number on it had been messed about with and it wasn't standard. I gave you the number, and you pointed out anything with the number 5 in front of it on a frame number means it was made in Nebraska.
Yeah, in the USA.
Is that right?
That's right. Well, Kawasaki had, since 1975, they were making bikes to get around tax laws, really. They weren't making bikes, they were actually just putting them together. They were getting all the parts from Japan and then assembling them in America. So to differentiate between the Japanese-built bikes, they put a number 5 on the frame number. So instantly that tells us it was made in America. Not that that's a bad thing. But, of course, there was a lot of frame numbers that began 05. So then people start getting confused and thinking, oh, the 0 must be missing. So then it gets quite confusing and they don't know what model it is. But of course, I knew that because 40 odd years of experience.
Exactly. Now, it's that kind of product knowledge that one has difficulty with when you're restoring proper vintage bikes, something born in the 30s, 40s and 50s.
Well, what's going to happen when we've gone?
I've no doubt people will carry on, because I don't think you'll ever change the interest in motorcycle.
Maybe they'll have a virtual restorer on the internet.
Perhaps, yes. Perhaps it'll become a game that you press buttons with instead.
Right, now, going back to the 80s, I remember coming to your place and outside your garage was a Yamaha VMAX, a 1200 V4. I'd never seen one before, and I was quite impressed the fact that you've got that. And then I came again not that long after, and you had this massive donkin Harley Davidson. Looked like it had been made out of one piece of aluminium. And then as the years went past, I noticed then there was a BMW 1200 GS on, most of us, you'd come to the fact that, you wanted a comfortable bike. So you was obviously always into bikes, and you was riding them. Do you still ride them now?
Yes, I do. I've enjoyed riding motorcycles all my life, and I even raced a Norton at one point at Darley Moor and Cadwell Park and places like that, you'll recall.
Yes.
As a MAG member once said, I think he was called Ian Much, if anybody's got memory of him.
I'm sure they all remember the MAG, which was the Motorcycle Action Group.
That's right, right. Yeah, he said motorcycles are for visiting this world. I'll repeat that. Motorcycles are for enjoying this world, not visiting the next.
Yes. It's a great saying.
So I've had bikes all my life, and I will always have them. And when I think back about character of motorcycles, I would say that the most sociable bike I ever had was a Harley Davidson.
Because of the lifestyle, or?
Well, in those days, there was one dealer in England. He was called Fred Waugh.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, there was one Harley club, and they have an annual event in Shipley each year. And I used to attend that rally and lots of rallies in Europe, all organised by the Harley club.
That's not quite true. When I first started at Knott Mill in 1977, we were Harley Davidson. Oh, yeah, it may have gone by then, yeah. We were Harley Davidson.
Yes, but I think wasn't that... Yes.
Well, my boss Arthur got rid of him. He didn't want him.
There was some confusion in that area, now that you've said it. You've refreshed my memory there.
I think Sports Motorcycles took it over eventually.
Were they called AMF then?
American Motorcycle Federation, Ed Kajivas and all that, there was a mixture of different bikes.
That aside, it was a great social bike, the Harley. But the only bike that ever gave me the sense of freedom was the Kawasaki.
A Z1?
Yes, it was. I had one. I used to go to Greece, Morocco, did it for years, all the way there, all the way back. And the feeling that you could go anywhere in the world reliably without any headaches was a fantastic thing.
Yeah.
So that I remember the Kawasaki for that, the Harley for social life.
So why did you buy the VMAX? You just wanted the power and the
glory. It was something I bought in California. Wasn't particularly interested in it, to be perfectly honest. In fact, it was so powerful.
That's probably why I'd never seen one, because if it was an American import, they didn't start to import them until later, did they?
There used to be a courier firm in Manchester, and the owner of that, whose name eludes me, what was he called, Dave?
Was it Road Rider?
Yes, it was.
Yes.
Keith, was he called
Keith?
Yeah, it was Keith. Yes. He bought it from me.
They're probably still going.
Yeah, he bought it from me. But to get back to your original question, at the moment I've got a 660cc single cylinder lightweight Yamaha.
It comes to us all.
I can manage that. It's not heavy. I can push it around the garden. It rides lovely.
Yeah.
But I really want to buy the new Triumph Scrambler. The truth would know.
All right. Yeah. I like them. Yeah. I like them. I like the Scramblers. Yeah. I've had a few Triumphs in my time. Well, Steve, that comes to the end of the interview. I could carry on for ages, of course, but that's it. Thanks for coming in today, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
No problem. Thank you, David.
I listen to FabRadioInternational.com.
Hey, this next section is going to be my favourite part. It's where I get to answer questions from our listeners on anything to do with bikes. Remember to email any questions you might have to us on motorcycleviews@yahoo.com or find us on Facebook. OK, Michelle, what's the first question?
Craig from Devon. What does Honda actually mean?
Ooh. Well, Honda actually means, and they all sound stupid, these, but it means original rice paddy. Whether that means the original rice paddy field, I don't know. But while we're at it, Kawasaki, River Edge or River Cape. Suzuki, a bell tree. Not a real tree, I think it's like a musical instrument. Yamaha, mountain leaf. Don't make any sense at all, does it? But there you go. Next one.
Greg from Fife, who invented the first motorcycle?
Oh, Moses, I thought. The Bible says the roar of Moses' triumph is heard throughout the hillside. No, really. It was in 1885 by Gottlieb Daimler. But not everybody agrees with that. The English and the Americans also claim they were the first. We may never know. But yeah, 1885, Daimler. Right, Shell, next one.
Rick from Telford. I keep hearing you talk about DOHC. What does it mean?
DOHC, it's an acronym. Double Overhead Camshaft. The Japanese love their acronyms. We have OHC, overhead cam, OHV, overhead valve, ECU, engine control unit, ABS, everybody knows that one, anti-lock braking system, AVDS, CDI, VTEC, which is variable valve timing and lift electronic control. They're all very confusing. They just love them over there. Hope that answers your question. You got another one, Shell?
Alan from Nottingham. What happened to the goose?
Oh, we ate it for Christmas, didn't we? I presume he's meaning... You're doing these to embarrass me, aren't you? I presume he means that bike I built, the goose, as we called it. It was a replica bike from Mad Max. If you remember Mad Max 1, the first movie, there was a policeman in it called Jim Goose, and he rode this this Kawasaki that had what you'd expect from a police bike, sirens and horns and everything. Jim Goose was played by a guy called Steve Bisley. I built a replica of one. I'd always wanted to do, and there was a company in Japan called White House who were doing fairing kits, so I bought one of them. Got a Z1000, put it all together. Cost me a fortune. I think about... Stood me at about £14,000, but it was great. I took it to shows, and everybody was mad keen on it, playing with the siren and the radio and the alarms, everything. But we just couldn't sell it. Nobody would buy it. We started off at about 20 grand, went down to like 15 grand, 13 grand, 12 grand, 10, nothing. And then I sold it for peanuts, 6,000 quid, I think, just to get rid of it because I got fed up of it, lost money, and it broke my heart. And then the guy I sold it to apparently rung me up when I was on holiday and said to one of the lads at work, just tell Dave that I've been offered 20,000 quid for that that goose bike, just to rub salt in the wounds, yes. I don't like talking about that one, but yeah, I hope that's what answers your questions. Right, Shell, have you got another one?
Frank from Texas, USA. Great show, Dave, but I can't understand some of your words and phrases.
Oh, sorry to hear that, Frank. It's my English northern accent. We do talk a little strange up here. I'll try harder to speak correctly. Sorry, can we get subtitles for radio? Go on, next one.
Yes, Simon from Yeovil. I was thinking of buying a Yamaha VMAX as an everyday commuter bike. Do you think it's a wise choice?
Simon, any bike is a wise choice. But to be brutally honest, no. It's too big and it's too heavy. Go for something more agile, a 500 or a 650 or something. That'd be a better choice. Not that a VMAX is not a good bike. I've had a few, but no. Next.
Yes, Dave from York. Do I have to tell my insurance company that I fitted an aftermarket exhaust on my MT10?
Yes. It probably won't increase your premium, but they may use it against you if you ever came to make a claim. If you don't tell them these things, they do get upset. In fact, you should tell them anything non-standard that you've put on the bike. Non-disclosure can be a very expensive mistake to make. Any more, Shell?
No, Dave.
OK, well, we'll do this week's movie question. In the film No Limit, that's that 1935, so you'll if you can remember this one, you'll be good. What was the name of the team that George Shuttleworth rode for? I'll tell you the answer later.
across the world, 24 hours a day. This is Fab Radio International.
Right. The answer to that movie question, by the way, is Rainbow Motorcycle Company. Did you get it? Okay, next I have an interview with John Spencer from Not Your Average Bike. They're in Ossett in West Yorkshire. They're the region's main dealer for the electric Zero bikes. I popped up to his shop a few weeks ago with my mobile mic, and here's what he had to say. First time using this mobile mic, so bear with me. Okay, John, tell me about Zero as a company. Where did they start?
So Zero founded in California in 2006 by a former NASA engineer. They solely make electric bikes. That's all they do. It's not a tech company that diversified into electric bikes. It was set up with a sole principle of just creating 100% electric motorcycles. They started off with off-road type bikes, starting in 2006, and then in 2010 they started actual sort of mass production as such of the electric bikes, and they're still based in California now.
So how did Not Your Average Bikes, your company, become a dealer? What made you go for that?
As the name suggests, we do Not Your Average Bikes. So we've started off our business with choppers and bobbers and cafe racers, and it was just a progression from there. We sort of saw the emergence of the electric bike market and thought, yeah, we're interested in that. It's something different. It's not your normal kind of bike. So we went and test rode a couple of them, had a great fun on them, and we're just enamoured from that point onwards and decided, right, this is what we want to do, and got in touch with Zero a bit deeper and had the conversation of becoming a dealer, and here we are.
How long ago was that? When did you start selling them?
About 18 months ago now.
So what's the best seller in the range?
To be honest, the range is all pretty evenly split in terms of popularity. Zero have got a few different styles of bikes. So you have the FX model, which is a sort of trail kind of green laning bike, in a motocross style, and there's a supermoto sister to that one. Then there's a street naked bike, and a slightly longer travel suspension version, which is a bit more for the American trail riding sort of market. And then they've got the new model, the SRF, which is the latest, greatest, all singing, all dancing electric bike that they've ever produced. So it's a real spread across the different models, depending on what the customer's looking for, really, in a bike.
Well, that new model, the SRS, it's been released soon, isn't it? It's not, is it on the showroom floor yet, is it?
No, not as yet. It's just been released this last couple of weeks. So the SRS will be hitting our showroom probably end of March, start of April.
And what's good about that? What have they improved on that model?
So the SRS is based on the SRF, which was launched last year, which was the next generation of electric bikes. But the SRS, the new one, is...
is it a fared bike? Is it going to be a fared bike?
Fully fared electric bike that Zero have ever made, which is a big step forward, because when we're talking about electric bikes, the aerodynamics... A massive impact, yeah, when we're talking about the range of the bikes and what sort of mileage you can get out of a battery charge.
Well, we're coming to that. How do you actually charge it? Is it just to plug it into the wall socket or what?
So, yeah, I think some people seem to think they're going to need a load of high-tech gadgetry to charge them, but every single Zero motorcycle that they produce, you can charge it from a standard 3-pin wall plug. Granted, it won't charge extremely quickly, it'll just be what we call a slow charge.
Yeah.
But every single model you can charge from a standard 3-pin plug, put the bike in your garage, take it to work, plug it to the standard wall socket, and it'll charge up. There are some of the models where they come with fast chargers as standard, some models you can upgrade them with a fast charging unit as an optional extra. So yeah, there's a range depending on what sort of riding you want to do, what your main use of the bike is, whether it's for commuting or it's for going touring or it's for a quick Sunday blast. Depends whether a quick charger really is a necessity or not for you.
So how long did it take to fully charge on, like, the normal plug socket?
So on a normal plug socket, the charging will range from sort of 7 or 8 hours, dependent upon the model. Different models have different rate charges on board them, so they're not all the same. But generally speaking, you're talking 7 or 8 hours for a full charge from empty to 100%.
And the special fast charger, what difference does that make?
So on a special fast charger, you can get the charging down to as low as an hour and a half if you have the right setup on the bike and the charger that you're using is quick enough.
And what does that still plug into a... That's a separate unit, and you can still plug it into a plug socket, normal plug socket.
So you can still plug into a normal plug socket if you wanted to do, but if you wanted to use the fast charger, you can use the same charging sockets as most of the modern electric cars do now. For example, we run VW e-Golfs as our daily cars, and it's the same plug socket as they use. So if you pulled up at a supermarket or a retail centre or somewhere like that where there is a fast charger for a car, chances are you'll be able to plug your Zero into that charger.
So how much does it cost to recharge on the slow charge overnight?
So if you can get it down to a cost of recharge from as little as 50 pence to recharge one of the smaller battery models, if you're looking at an overnight charger at home. If you're using your home charger through the daytime, you might be talking 70 pence on the smaller batteries, about £1.50 on the larger batteries. So, and a larger battery will do you 120 miles or so.
All right, yeah, so it's quite cheap really, isn't it?
Mm.
So, what licence do you need? I mean, it always confuses me, this licence law, because, of course, when I passed my test, it was just round the block four times. So, what sort of licence do you need? Does it go off brake horsepower or what?
It is done on the power output of the bikes. Electric bikes are measured differently to petrol bikes. So a petrol bike, you would have the figure that they would use would be the maximum power output, and the limitations are based on that. With electric bikes, they run a test called continuous net power, which is a bit of a bizarre testing system, yeah, really. But I think that was probably came around just when electric bikes were first introduced, and they would have a very short burst of 100% of the power.
Yeah.
And the realistic continuous power was a lower level. Modern bikes now, for the electric bikes, that's less of the case. There is still a bit of a burst of power that you can get over and above the normal day-to-day, but the general power of them now is fantastic. But in terms of licensing, you can get a Zero on what they call an 11 kilowatt model, which means you can ride on a CBT, but it'll do 85 mile an hour and it'll get there,
yeah,
extremely quick.
Is that like equivalent to a 125?
Yeah, so a 125 equivalent.
CC.
So 17 year old and above, 125 petrol bike equivalent, yeah, you can ride one of those. But some of the bikes, you need a full A license for the SRF.
Yeah,
you
obviously.
You need an A2 license for the DS.
This is where you're losing me now, where two licenses and four.
Yeah, it's complicated. I think I'm in the middle between when you did your test four times around the block and the modern day test where you have to sit three or four different parts to a test.
Yes.
I'm somewhere in the middle, but it's still confusing.
I'd probably fail these days. I hope I don't have to take it again. So, what sort of range can you expect, really? You mean, be truthful, in the real world?
Real world, I mean, I've ridden a lot of miles on these bikes myself just because I enjoy them myself. I took one of the Zero FX models, a trail riding kind of model, up to the Isle of Mull with me in Scotland last summer, and I was doing 75 miles on a charge. So that's got a smaller battery in that one. That's what we call a 7.2 kilowatt hour battery.
Okay.
In something like the S model or the DS or the SRF, you can get a 14.4 kilowatt hour battery, so twice the size. On one of those, you're likely in the real world with a mixture of town riding and a little bit of highway riding, you get probably 120 miles.
Well, that's not too bad. I mean, I can't believe it when it actually does better round town than it does on the open road. It's hard to believe, but yeah, that's the way it works, isn't it?
They're the opposite to the petrol bikes, in terms of consumption.
Now, there's no road tax to pay on them, is there?
No, zero road tax at the moment. I'm sure that might change potentially in the future when the government sees fit, but for now, all electric vehicles are zero road tax.
Now, what about insurance? Is it dearer, cheaper, same? Do they know, do the insurance companies actually group them in a different group?
So does the insurance companies, not all insurance companies up to date, a fully understanding of the electric bike market. So there are a few of the companies that are a bit more specialist when it comes to the insurance. But in terms of cost of the insurance, they're fairly comparable with a petrol bike of a similar value and a similar power.
Yeah.
You can't come in from riding a Suzuki 650 Bandit and think that it's going to be the same cost to insure a £20,000 zero
with
twice the power. It's going to be more expensive. But
what age group are buying them?
Generally speaking, we've had from the ages of late 20s up to mid 70s.
Oh, right, so it's a wide range.
Yeah, it's funny the people that it attracts.
So what bikes are they part exchanging? I mean, presumably they're part exchanging.
That's just as funny as the range of people, really. We've had one customer who part exchanged a Kawasaki H2SX, the supercharged sports tourer. He swapped one of those in for a new Zero SRF. He actually runs a rider training school and was using his H2SX. To follow his students on. Yeah,
bit of overkill, really, that, isn't it?
Yeah, so the electric bike for him is perfect because he doesn't have to go up and down a gearbox all day long. The power's there if he needs it, but he can just gently cruise around, nice and smooth, no vibration, no noise.
Yeah.
He can listen to what his students are doing. We've had a customer that part exchanged an American chopper made by a company called Big Dog. There's a Big Dog Pitbull, a 2 litre stretched out American OCC style chopper.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then we've got people part exchange everyday bikes like CB500Xs and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Day-to-day. Oh, well, there's a wide choice of bikes that are coming in part exchange. Now, there's a government's cash incentive, I presume, like these on cars.
Yeah, at the moment there's a plugging motorcycle grant, it's called. Which is 20% of the new value of the bike with a maximum cap of £1,500. So on a zero, it'd be £1,500 discounted. All the prices that we advertise, we already take that £1,500 off of the.
All right, okay, so that's already deducted from the retail price.
Yeah, unfortunately, the government aren't quick at paying out the grants. So
no, that sounds about right.
So rather than getting the customers to pay for it and then them have the hassle of chasing it up and dealing with something unusual to them, we just take that off up front and we sort that out.
So you've got a guy out on a test ride and he comes back. What's the reaction you get from him?
Normally giggling. Lots of giggling. The reactions that we get are 99% the same. Always people with a big smile on their face saying things like, I thought it'd be good, but I didn't think it'd be that good. Or the power on it's phenomenal. They're so nice to ride. It sounds a bit salesman speakish. But
it's all positive.
But it's the reality. People don't know really what to expect from them until they've ridden them. And then when they've ridden them, they think, wow, I didn't think that would have been that good.
Yeah, yeah. Has it scared anyone? Because there's phenomenal talk on them, haven't
it surprised a lot of people, yeah. We sent one customer out on a test ride on one of our demo days, and without telling him, I sent him out on one of the CBT legal, so 125cc legal equivalents. Didn't tell him. And this customer rides a Harley Road King as his daily bike.
All right.
So he's used to big power, big torque. Anyway, we sent him out on it, he came back, and he went, that's fantastic. He said, I know I shouldn't say it because I'm a Harley rider, but that's fantastic, is that? I said, well, would you believe it if I told you that that was a 125cc equivalent? He went, no.
Well, of course, Harley have got their live wire coming out, but it's nowhere near as powerful as the Zeros, is it?
It's not quite as powerful as the Zero SRF,
no.
But it's a different type of, a different approach to electric bikes is the Harley. They use something called DC fast charging, whereas the vast majority of other vehicles use the normal everyday charging
system
cars are using. So it is a bit of a different animal. They've got a bit of artificially inserted noise, I think, into them.
They have, yes. I saw them at the NEC. They've got like that turbine noise on them, which sounded a bit Mickey Mouse-ish, really. But you know, I suppose they've got to make it different somehow for £30,000.
Yeah, they're a lot of money. They're a nice looking machine. Yeah. Given that they seem to have kept the Harley essence of visuals of a bike.
So is Hero working on a better battery for increased range? Because that's going to be the killer no matter what, isn't it, that range?
There's nothing that's publicly known about what Zero are doing in terms of advancement of batteries. We know that all manufacturers of electric vehicles are always looking to advance the batteries. Zero's batteries have come on a long way over the years. They started out with much smaller batteries. I think the first battery was maybe a 6 kilowatt hour battery, I think, and then it went up to maybe a 9, and then a 10, and then they had a 12.3, I think, and a 13.5, and now we're up to a 14.4. So it's forever developing, and that battery's the same size, they're just getting more power packs into the battery casings.
Yeah.
But it's forever developing.
I mean, I've got an Africa Twin, which is the DCT, you know, the automatic one, and I love it. I mean, I don't mind not changing gear, but it's got a bit of a noise on it. But when I go out to ride, it's usually for a couple of thousand miles, you know, it's a big ride. So the electric one at the moment is not as appealing to me, and I guess that's going to be the stumbling block for most riders. But from a commuter point of view, it's perfect, isn't it?
Yeah, for commuters, they're great. You can save a lot of money over the lifetime of a bike if you use your bike every day to commute. You think about the amount of petrol you're putting into the bike, you've got the road tax every year, you've got a lot more servicing to do on a petrol bike than you do on an electric. Electric bikes, there's a minimal amount of servicing on them year after year after year. You'd never end up with the major services for valve clearances or exhausts that have rotten and need replacing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of components that just don't exist on electric bikes.
Yeah, I suppose that's why people say, oh, I'm not riding that washing machine or that sewing machine. But in reality, washing machines don't break down, do they? Well, no. Not electrically, anyway.
I think a lot of people assume that because it's an electric vehicle, it'll be like a milk float, or it'll have soul. Or we get a lot of this from bikers who say, no, it'll be the death of biking, well, electric bike. But until you've ridden one, it's hard to really explain what the sensations are like. It's just like riding a bike, but it's also different to riding a bike.
Yeah.
You've got the DCT on your bike, which is different to your standard, so you've got no clutch, you're not changing gears all the time. The Zeros is a single gear direct drive, straight from the motor, straight to the wrist sprocket. There's no gearbox in there at all, so it's not even like the DCT where you can still feel
the gear change.
For you. With the Zeros, you go into a bend, you're in the right gear, it doesn't matter. You don't have to get into a bend and go, oops, I think I probably need to drop a gear and unsettle the bike.
Yeah.
You're in the right gear every time. You come out of that bend, and if you've got a car in front of you, you don't need to drop a gear to go around it. You just wind on, and it's gone.
Well, I'll find that out soon, because I'll be going out on one. Now, so if our listeners wanted to test ride a Zero, how would they go about it?
We've always got demo bikes in stock here at our showroom. We also do demo days where we have a full fleet of bikes all available all day long. So, pop down to the showroom, give us a ring if you want to book a specific time, and we'll just fill out a form.
What do they need? Just the licence and the national insurance number, as usual?
Driving licence and national insurance number, and that's it, basically.
Well, that's great. Well, thanks for speaking to us, John.
No problem.
I'm looking forward to the test ride.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll be laughing.
So, this is the end of the show. You've been listening to Dave Marsden on Fab Radio International on Motorcycle Views. Join us next time for more motorcycle madness. Don't forget to send in your questions and listen to our podcast. Stay safe.